This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Well, should MLAs get a pay rise? There's going to be a knee-jerk no on all of that, but if their equivalents in Scotland are getting 19 grand a year more, why not here? All discussed in the full force way that is a Nolan show, then a really, really interesting conversation about not just boxing, but other contact sports and the likelihood. Carl Frampton was on the programme yesterday. If you want to find that, go on the BBC Sounds and search. I'm going to look up what day it is today. I have no idea what day it is. Wednesday today, so if you search Tuesday the 4th Nolan Show, you'll hear the Frampton interview. Carl revealing that he expects to get dementia in later life because of how long he's been boxing for. So we get a neuroscientist on to talk about the likelihood and of dementia and the dangers of contact sports, including rugby and others. It's really interesting. We're on today's programme. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. MLAs have passed a motion to allow for an independent board to be set up to review their salaries. The new panel, that they will have the sole remit of setting pay and pension entitlements for MLAs, which is why it's really interesting what is in the Assembly Commission report. As I said just before the news there this morning, they have said that it would be helpful to note that an equivalent to an MLA in Scotland is on 19 grand a more a year now at present. They've also said that it is highly likely that an independent review board would give them a pay rise. So why are the people that have set up the independent review board telling that review board, here, it would be highly likely that MLAs get a pay rise? Why haven't they remained completely neutral? More to the point this morning, do they deserve 19 grand a year more? 0-30-30-80-55-55 is the number to call this morning. 81771 on the text. Here's the DUP's Trevor Clark.
I'm probably at the upper end in terms of age. There's many younger members in this who have young families and have families to keep. Why should they not stay in kilter with their counterparts in other places? I'm happy to let you in if you want in on that one.
Somebody has a young family myself and don't take the full average wage, I don't see why you can use that as a justification to bump and support MLA getting a pay increase of 28%. It doesn't stand up.
All right, it doesn't stand up in your mind, but it stands up in others, because once you don't take it, that's your choice. Other members have young families. I will.
Way, because in this it confers the functions of alliances to the Assembly Commission, which actually enabled alliances for members to take maternity leave, some things that the independent body beforehand didn't do. So I'm actually quite proud that the Assembly Commission has moved forward in that, to support in particular young families within this building.
And can I thank the member for putting that on the record? As a member whose family's growing up, I'll have no need for that. But of course it is important, whenever you're looking at workers' rights, you look right across the board at all of their rights.
So Mr Clark and the DUP saying, look, 51 grand a year isn't enough. We want 70 grand a year. It has stayed the same since 2016, to be fair. And if you want really good people, does that come with really good salaries? From 51 grand a year to 70 grand a year. Timothy Gaston from the TUV with us this morning. Morning to you, Timothy.
Morning, Stephen.
So, look, easy to have a pop with people for wanting more money, but why should Northern Ireland pay less than Scotland or Wales? Why?
Well, Stephen, so they're wanting to compare the pay with Scotland or Wales. If we take a step back, then we have to do the comparison of what duties the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Parliament carry out. Like, let's be honest about this. So on Monday, we were hearing all the positives of a year of devolution has returned, how great this is. That was Monday in the Chamber. On Tuesday in the Chamber, now we're talking about bringing in this independent review with an aim to increase salaries by £19,000. But let's look at the functions of Scotland.
No, an independent review panel. It's not predetermined. You have no evidence it's predetermined. None.
Well, once this panel comes back with its report, and you can play that clip back again to see if I'm right or I'm wrong. But let's look at the functions of Stormont and how it has performed over the last year. You know, we're meant to legislate. Has there been any real legislation? Scrutiny committees are meant to scrutinise. My goodness, they don't carry out that function very well. And let's not forget that back in December, we gave away the powers to 300 areas of law that should sit within the remit of the UK. We have given them away to a foreign parliament. So surely this independent review, and that was my encouragement to them yesterday, to judge Stormont on what they've delivered and what they have given away. So if you're wanting to set a pay, and if this is independent, you have to take them factors into account, and please reflect that when you come back. Is Stormont worth the current money they're getting? We'll soon find out. But I am very, very sceptical about the independence of this independent review. Back in December, I raised the issue in the chamber. There was a paper that was there for the scrutiny, which highlighted this. So this has been the stepping stone to get to this position. So this report was dropped in December. To give the context, it was a briefing to assist the Audit Committee's scrutiny of the Assembly Commission's budget for 25-26, and it said that there's £19,000 less that MLAs were getting paid than those of the Scottish Parliament. So this has been little stepping stones to get to this position. So dropped it in December. We had the big fanfare on Monday where they had the big celebration of devolution has been here a year and how great we are. And then Tuesday, bang, we're in to set the foundations to increase the salaries of MLAs. And that's where it's going, Stephen. Anybody else that thinks something different?
Well, the Assembly Commission have said it's highly likely they've said it's perhaps helpful to note that the current salary for a member is now more than 19
grand
less.
Why would they put that in? Why would they put that in? If this is independent, why would they meddle? Why would they put in a figure into a report? Why would they say that it's £19,000 less? Stephen, I have heard from a number of different parties, I've heard from different MLAs over the last number of weeks that this pay rise will be £72,000. This is what's been talked about within parties. And that's why when it came to the debate yesterday,
from 51 to 72.
Well, I think it's 52,500 at the minute, from recollection, and then it would be moving up to what either the lower end, whatever the Scottish Parliament is, or the Welsh Parliament. That is what the predetermined outcome is, and that's what MLAs are pushing for in the background. Yesterday was a bit...
Once again,
there
is no predetermined outcome. There is no evidence of that. There is evidence, or, you know, it's written in black and white, of what the Assembly Commission have noted, and they want the Remuneration Board to note. They say, quote, "It therefore seems highly likely that a Remuneration Board will increase members' salaries." Why did the Assembly Commission not remain neutral on that and let the independent body?
Well, if the independent body was to maintain its independence, the Assembly Commission wouldn't have put that in the report. So I understand, you know, you have to come at this from both sides and you have to come with a counter-argument. But what you're saying is, you know, as evidence for the argument that I'm making. And yesterday was about exposing that. So before it gets
except
to the
stage, the Assembly Commission has no jurisdiction over the Remuneration Board. Look, this is a distraction from the main argument. The main argument here is whether the public feel that MLAs here should be paid the same as their counterparts in the likes of Scotland and Wales. And why should, you know, people here who choose to go into politics not be paid a comparable salary to elsewhere? Let me stay there, Timothy. Let me bring Brendan Mulgrew in. You might be wondering, why the TV are at the top of the show. Well, guess what? We asked all the five main parties. We contacted them yesterday. We asked them to come on to the Nolan Show to talk to you about their pay. Not one of them from any of the political parties are available. Robbie Butler was on with Buckler this morning on Good Morning Ulster, and Robbie was saying that he wouldn't be drawn on whether he thinks 19 grand of an increase is appropriate or not. The SDLP came back to us with a statement. We asked them on, they came back with a statement, and they said the SDLP does not believe it's appropriate that political representatives at any level should be tasked with setting their own pay or allowances. An appropriate outside body, they say, should be established to handle these decisions and regularly review pay to ensure full transparency around these processes and ensure no conflict of interest arises. We did ask the SDLP in our written questions to them, we did say, does the party support an increase in MLA salaries? And does the party support an alignment with counterparts in Scotland and Wales, which would be £19,000? And the SDLP have ducked answering that question, as have the other political parties as well. Brendan Mulgrew, morning to you. What are your thoughts?
Good morning, Stephen. I'm probably going to go against the grain here somewhat, Stephen, and maybe it's a bit, maybe some of the other parties should be explaining to your listeners what actually happened in the Assembly yesterday, because it was, I know the headlines are quite eye-watering and maybe intentionally so, but I mean that was actually quite a sort of a political, technical thing which happened yesterday around establishing the independent body. But I suppose the key question is, what are our MLAs worth compared with their counterparts across the water? So there is it's just a fact that there is a big disparity between what Scottish representatives get and what Welsh representatives get paid. It's around £20,000. Are our MLAs underpaid? Maybe they are. Are those representatives overpaid? Maybe that's the answer. Maybe the answer is somewhere in the middle, Stephen. So I would say let that independent body be established. Make a genuine assessment of what the pay is, when it was last raised beyond inflation, and what it should be as we go forward. And the politics...
Robbie Butler said to Buckler this morning, some MLAs don't even turn up. I don't know if you clocked that. I never fell off my seat.
I did. He said some MPs. He said some MPs didn't turn up. I think that was the point he was making, because he was on with Timothy's leader, and I think he wanted to throw a bit of the praise Jim Allister's way. And he talked about how effective Jim is in the House of Commons rather than MLAs.
Well, Jim's on 90-odd grand a year.
He is.
He's doing all right.
He is, and I wouldn't make a comparison between what MPs get in London nor what TDs get paid in Dáil Éireann. I think those are different types of more senior legislatures and legislative bodies. But when we're talking about devolved institutions, Stephen, do we want the best people out there to opt for a career in politics? And I think that goes to the point that Timothy made very well yesterday around the performance of our Assembly. It's underperforming.
We don't have the Assembly Commission saying it's highly likely that there will be a pay rise. We have no programme for government.
I agree. And I made that point on air on Monday. It's absolutely the biggest... The timing of this motion coming before the Assembly yesterday is quite unfortunate, because all eyes are on the Assembly given the one-year anniversary of restoration, and everyone's having their say about how effective or not they are. It's crazy that we don't have a programme for government. It's unacceptable.
Here's another counter, Timothy, which is this. That even if they got 19 grand more, even if they went into 70-odd grand, is that still too low? If you want the very best in politics in Northern Ireland, you look at what many top-ranking sales executives, managers, people in the BBC, people elsewhere in the media, all different sectors... 100 grand a year jobs are not typical, but they're not as rare as you would point out.
Yeah, well,
maybe these people need significant pay rises.
Oh, for goodness sake, Stephen, come on. Sure, we might as well give them the same as what the BBC, the presenters like yourself are on them in that case. But let's look at the output of the Assembly. My goodness, let's judge it on what's there. This should be performance related. So this independent review, and I want to go back to these three points. We're meant to legislate. Where's the legislation? It doesn't happen. It's non-binding motion after non-binding motion. Scrutiny committees failed. Haven't delivered when it comes to the McMonagle scandal. Failed miserably. Laid bare how useless they can be. And my goodness,
well, the scrutiny committee would very much say that they've done their job.
So if MLAs want their pay, if they want this increase, they need to start performing. And my time in Stormont has shown that the chamber's most of the time half empty. And they're, you know, what's going on? What business has been achieved in the year that it's been?
Well, there? You're talking about what's been achieved. Some people might argue that you're taking in 51 grand a year to disrupt and achieve nothing but disrupt.
I'm there to hold people to account. If they don't like that, well, there's not much I can do about that. I've been sent there with a job to do, and the feedback I'm getting on the ground is at least there's somebody in that chamber speaking up and speaking out against what's happening. If it wasn't for myself, if it wasn't for Gerry Carl raising this issue in the chamber yesterday, you know, it would have probably just slid on through, and the members of the public wouldn't have known what's at foot. Let's be clear, yesterday was about exposing what the plan of action is here. The foundations have been laid for a big pay increase, and I felt I had a duty, and I was convicted enough to lay it bare yesterday. Yesterday was the time to do it. Yes, the legislation, the member of the opposition was saying this wasn't the time to have this conversation, that's further down the line. I disagree. Yesterday was the time to highlight it, because it gives shows like yourself and other media outlets the opportunity to tell the public what's happening.
Let's find out what we feel this morning at 03030 80 55 55. We'll start with you, Gerard. Morning.
Morning, Stephen, and welcome back from your holiday.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd say is, if yes, they probably should get an increase, but I mean, I don't know who does these figures. If they just look up a comparison to what the cost of living in Scotland or Wales is, and it's approximately 1.2% more expensive to live in Wales or Scotland. If you work that out, they should get then 61,000, not the 71,000 or whatever they're talking.
Jared, thank you. Norman and Bangor. Morning, Norman.
Morning, Stephen. The Yanks back in town.
What?
The Yanks back in town.
Yes, I'm back from my very short holiday.
Stephen, I find it unbelievable that these career politicians, because that's what they are, they're career politicians, it's only a talking shop up there, are wanting £19,000 of a raise when they wasted over £600 million on RHI heating scheme, £140 million on high street vouchers. They threw money to sports clubs and business during COVID that didn't need the money. And when it come to giving pensioners and vulnerable people the winter fuel allowance, they had no money. That's what they said. Well, there's no money to pay it.
Well, they haven't said they want 19 grand, but the Assembly Commission has said it would be helpful to note, Norman, the £19,000 more that Scottish MSPs are getting. Helpful to note. Helpful to who?
Oh, no, Stephen, there's 49 ministers run the whole of Canada, and here we have over 100 MLAs at Stormont. Why do we need half of them? And here we have north-south bodies with all these quangos that set up costing hundreds of millions of pounds. Well, maybe if they got rid of all them, they could get their pay.
You have heard over recent days on this programme and other programmes, ministers coming on telling you what they have delivered in just 12 months. Well, that's not true, is it? That's not true, is it?
Look at the health service. It's on its knees. Cancer patients, other people have to go private to get operations.
And Mike Nesbitt would say he's working day and night to try to improve the waiting list, to try to improve the health service.
He's not fixing nothing. Why do we need such health trusts when one health trust could do the whole lot? And we're throwing hundreds of millions of pounds at the private sector.
Now, what I don't know, Timothy Gasson, do you, or Brendan, do you, if the MLA's pay goes up, does the minister's pay? So they get an additional payment. A minister gets an additional payment on top of their MLA salary, right? So would a minister's pay, that segment, that extra payment for being a minister, would that go up as well? Or are we just talking here about MLA pay, Timothy? Do you know?
As far as I know, Stephen, solely focused on MLA pay, but there's those in the business a lot longer than me that will be able to confirm that. I would presume that if MLA pay goes up through time, that's the logical next step. So it wouldn't surprise me that will be the next thing that they look at. But Stephen, yeah. can I make this
Emma
point?
And Michelle get 124 grand each.
And what does the Prime Minister get?
I have no idea.
Compare that to the Prime Minister. Stephen, can I make this point? I received a message this morning from somebody that works in Northern Ireland Water. So their response to Storm Owen was hampered by their staff members, who usually do a lot of overtime and really come in and put their shoulder to the wheel when there's a crisis. When they were asked, would they come in and help out to get the water flowing again in Northern Ireland at certain points, their response was, well, listen, you haven't sorted out our pay for 23-24.
Well, you're floating that obviously off the hoof this morning. We would need to go back and check that, Timothy.
Yeah, so what sort of an example does this give to other people? So we've had nurses out in strike. We have issues within, the education system. What sort of message does this give out? The MLAs are looking after themselves when they still haven't the rest of the public sector sorted.
Can I just be clear about the message you're giving out? So if the independent pay review body does give MLAs circa a 20 grand pay rise, are you going to hand 20 grand of it back?
Well, Stephen, I don't get to decide what pay I get.
Oh, that's not my question.
Let me expand on this. MLA's salary is always a contentious issue, and it's rightly so. The pay I get at the minute, I give a certain amount of that away to like-minded charities, ones that align with my beliefs. And if there is any pay rise, and I don't believe it should be anywhere near what it is, but if there's any pay rise at all, I will continue to support them charities, and I will increase that. Because let me tell you,
but if you're objecting, Timothy, to the 20 grand, will you give the whole 20 grand away to charity?
What will Stormont do with the money if I don't take it? They'll fund, there'll be more sandwiches for Northern Ireland Water, there'll be more hospitality.
So if the independent,
what I want to do as a good steward, if I do get more money, I will steward that into causes that
all
I
of it
believe
or some of
is
it.
Worthy. When you take out the tax, I'm sure it'll all go because there's a lot goes at the minute.
Brendan?
But I wonder what Timothy thinks is a fair wage. Is the current wage too high? Should it be lobbying to reduce the wages? Or is the current wage a fair enough wage?
So looking at it at the minute, I have said that I give some of my wage away. When I stepped into this role, I took a pay cut.
Given that the child,
so I'm here through conviction.
Just ask them what you think is a fair wage.
Well, it's up to this. I don't know what a fair wage for an MLA is.
But you know what a rise is wrong. That's what I'm trying to get at. What do you think a fair wage is? Do you think a rise is wrong? Is the current wage
Well,
fair
you
wage?
Look, so have they determined that £52,500 was right for what work was carried out? Because
He's not asking you what they determined. He's asking you what you think is a fair wage for an MLA. It's a clear, straight question. As you often say in these scrutiny committees when you're asking others, answer the question.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying to you, Stephen, is that Stormont has given away power, so that should be reflected. When Stormont was down, the big thing was that, you know what, Assembly, your pay should be cut accordingly, simply because you're not carrying out the full functions of your job role. On that basis, if we've given away 300 areas of law, we certainly shouldn't be looking at getting a pay increase. I give away part of my salary as it stands at the minute.
Fair
because
enough.
I don't believe that it's worth the money that we're doing for non-binding motions.
David in Belfast. Morning, David.
A mobile, yep.
Hello, David.
Hello.
Good morning. You're a carer, David.
Yes, David. I'm sitting here and I'm absolutely disgusted because I have to live on £81-£82 a week of carer's allowance, and the MLAs are getting a £19,000 pay rise. Seriously. I am absolutely disgusted. I don't even know where my next pair of shoes is coming from. I don't know where I can put food on the table. It's a disgrace.
Well, remember that they don't reward themselves with a pay rise, but the Assembly Commission has all of the political parties sitting on it, the main political parties sitting on it, David, and they have said it would be helpful to note what their counterparts in Scotland are getting, 19 grand a year more. And they've also said it would be highly likely that an independent body would give them a pay rise.
Well, maybe it's just to get into the curves and see what they have to look on. Maybe they should look into that and see what they have to live on, because we're living on buttons to what the MLAs are getting. 19,000 people live at less than 19,000 per year, and they're getting a 19,000 payment. It's disgraceful. It's just looking after themselves.
Well, they don't decide. They're just.
Well, it doesn't matter. They're still tickets, Stephen. If they offered £19,000, they'll take it. They have to take it. That's the problem. Is they'll take the money. They're not going to give it to a food bank. They're not going to give it to people in need. They're just going to take the money.
And look, is there anything wrong with good, hard-working people who could maybe earn more money outside of politics?
And do you think I couldn't earn more money if I was in the car looking after someone 24/7? That's the problem. You need to realise what's going on here. You need to realise that carers could earn a lot more. I mean, I could earn more in a day than I'm getting in a week. And yet I'm looking after a severely disabled partner. And, you know, if you feel sick when you hear this, you really do feel sick. Stephen, I don't care what party it is, I'm not voting again. Not doing it.
What do you say to the MLAs this morning listening to this?
Stop being greedy. Even if it isn't, give it to people, give it to the food banks, give it to people in need. Stop just taking it and taking it and taking it, because it looks like to us, the poor people in this country, it looks like you're looking after yourself.
I'll remind you that nothing's been offered to the politicians yet, but this Assembly Commission, MLA sit on it, and they're saying it would be helpful to note what their counterparts are making. And you've heard Trevor Clark from the DUP saying, we played the clip to you. Let me just play Trevor Clark's clip to you one more time.
I'm probably at the upper end in terms of age. There's many younger members in this who have young families and have families to keep. Why should they not stay in kilter with their counterparts in other places?
What would you say to Mr. Clark, David?
Okay, it's you know, they're sitting on a different planet. At the end of the day, that you know, there are people in this country struggling to pay their bills, struggling to put their heat on, struggling to put food on their table. And here we have, again, the old club looking after themselves.
But they're not looking after themselves. It's an independent body.
And many of them, ask any of them, will they be giving their £19,000? If they get their raise, if they get the £19,000, will they be giving it to a charity?
Okay.
Ask Daniel.
David, thank you. Thank you very much, Timothy.
Can I respond to David?
We've got to go to the news, Timothy, very, very quickly.
Yeah, so what I'm doing now, I'm going into the office. I have set up the office as a collection point for the food bank. I regularly support the food bank. And if there is a pay rise, I can assure David and I can assure other people that the food bank will be one of the organisations I will continue to support.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Let's pause there and get the news from the BBC. Right, so here we are talking about MLA pay. My goodness, lots of you have stuff to talk about that. 030 30 80 55 55, and we'll come back to your calls later in the programme. So, the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, wasn't holding back yesterday, was he? He had a message for our politicians. Westminster has given you enough money. Now you need to get on and make do and start reform.
But given the needs-based formula that is now in place, and given the increase in funding that the government has given, a lack of funding is not the impediment to public services transformation. The real impediment has been the failure to reform the system. The many missed opportunities in the past to take decisions or to apply lessons from other parts of the UK where reform has happened. Of course, this has at times been down to the fact there was no executive in place to take those decisions, which is why it's essential that the institutions do their job every day of the year. At other times, it's simply been a lack of agreement amongst executive ministers on the steps that need to be taken, or on the allocation of resources, or on the revenue that needs to be raised.
He also highlighted the long health waiting lists people in Northern Ireland face compared to England.
Now, the challenge for public services is particularly acute in Northern Ireland, and nowhere is this more urgent or more obvious than in health. The facts are frankly shocking. Waiting time performance against cancer care targets continues to deteriorate. Corridor care is becoming more frequent, and it is striking how many people in Northern Ireland are now going private. More than a quarter of people in Northern Ireland are on a waiting list. That is more than double the figure in England. And 53% of people waiting for a first appointment with a consultant, just to be seen for the first time, are waiting for more than a year in Northern Ireland. In England, that figure is 4%. That's right, 53% compared to just 4%.
Well, clearly the Secretary of State having a pop there at the state of our health service here in Northern Ireland. The shadow, Conservative shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland is Alex Burkhardt. Good morning to you, Alex.
Stephen, thanks for having me on.
Alex, do you concur with Hilary Benn that the politicians should get on with reform now and they've got enough money?
So I thought it was a really interesting speech by Hillary yesterday. And he made three points, one about the reform of the necessary reform of health, one about the need to move towards smooth flow of goods around the United Kingdom, and one about sustainable growth. But let's start with health, as you've done, Stephen. When I've been talking to people in Northern Ireland, there is an understandable impatience for improvement because of the reasons that the Secretary of State set out, that there are some terrible waiting times. I've been told about people who have been told that they may have to wait 8 years for a procedure. I mean, at that point, you have to question whether you have a functioning health service at all. And you know, it is unacceptable that people in the UK are having to wait so long for treatment. And I think it's quite right that at some point, the Secretary of State says, yeah, you have a settlement now. It's time to show us what you can do.
So you support him saying, do you, to the local political parties, get on with it and look at the state of the health service? You support that? Are you saying the same thing?
I think that it is right that just as the people of Northern Ireland are challenging their politicians to say, please fix our public services now, that the Secretary of State should be able to say the same thing.
Many people might be looking at you and saying a lot of this is your party's fault. 14 years of austerity, they might say.
There wasn't 14 years of austerity. There was a period of austerity just after 2010, because there'd been a global financial crisis and there wasn't very much money. The main reason that there are problems in Northern Ireland is because of a lack of reform. Some of that is due to the fact that institutions have been suspended for reasons we're all very familiar with. But some of it is down to the fact that reforming decisions that have been taken in some other parts of the UK, not all parts of the UK, some other parts of the UK, have not been taken by the executive. I think it's right that we all encourage politicians in Northern Ireland to begin that process in earnest, because that is what people in Northern Ireland want.
You've got many political parties here, Alex, saying we are fundamentally underfunded. That if you want them, Gordon Lyons was on this programme 2 days ago, the Communities Minister. In fact, I'll play you what Gordon Lyons said to us. He's essentially saying, yeah, if you want reform, fair enough, but we're underinvested and we need a fair starting point. Let's have a listen. It was actually yesterday to what Gordon said.
The first thing that I would say is that Northern Ireland has not had sufficient funding for many, many years. We have been underinvested, and Gavin Robinson first raised this issue years ago, and others have started to recognise that as well. Now, the Secretary of State apparently today is going to say that reform is needed. And I agree, reform is needed, but there needs to be a recognition that reform requires investment. We need money for those upfront costs so we can make those longer term decisions that will give us money in the longer term. So that's what I hope we'll actually see from him, is a bit of recognition of the difficulties that we're in, because when we're in such a constrained...
It's just giving you loads of money when you went back in the Stormont.
But when we're in such a constrained budgetary environment, I can tell you we do not feel flush right now with the pressures that we are facing. And when you're under those pressures, it's very, very difficult for us to put funding aside and in place to do that investment for the long-term reform that we need. So I don't think you'll find anybody in the executive that says, no, we're not up for changing the way we do things. But the barrier has often been the upfront cost that's required to make those changes.
So, Alex, one of the approaches can be, as the Labour Party are doing, you've got what you've got, get on with the reform, make it happen. And another is waiting and expecting more money before the reform can be done in any meaningful way. Which do you think is the better approach?
Well, look, spending per capita in Northern Ireland is about £300 higher than it is in my constituency in Essex. Spending on public services in Northern Ireland, I think, is over £2,000 higher in Northern Ireland. Spending per head is about £2,000 higher in Northern Ireland than it is in my constituency in Essex. So, you know, I appreciate that there are, you know, some particular challenges in Northern Ireland, and I appreciate that transformation costs money. But there is, you know, there is a settlement there that you know, reflects Northern Ireland's needs base. If the executive thinks that it needs a specific amount of money to affect meaningful transformation, then it needs to come forward with a plan for that. But you know, we cannot have another period or where we don't see public services, not just health, and yeah, health is an absolutely key factor in most people's lives. We cannot have another period where health goes unreported and people are waiting an unacceptably long time for treatment.
We're also discussing today, Alex, whether MLAs in Northern Ireland should earn as much as their counterparts, for example, in Scotland, where a member of the Scottish Parliament earns around about 19 grand a year more. Do you think there should be parity?
Well, that is a local matter as far as I'm concerned. I mean,
You're the Shadow Secretary of State.
What do you mean it's a local matter?
Come on now.
Well, it is. Well, of course it is. I mean, it's something that's the nature of devolution, right? And I
But you are our Secretary of State, and I'm asking you for an opinion.
Something I can tell you.
Shadow Secretary of State.
Something that I can tell you that people do not enjoy is hearing politicians talk about their own pay. Yeah, that is, and you know, here in Westminster, we have an independent body that decides how much I get paid. That is absolutely the right way to do things. I do not want to be put in a position where I have to vote on how much I and my colleagues earn. That would be wrong.
That's not what I'm asking you.
No, I know. I'm just explaining what a good
I know, but Alex, this
like.
Is a red herring, isn't it?
No, it's not a red herring. The question is, who decides?
No,
right?
It's not my question.
That's how I'm setting it up. Come on, Stephen. This is clearly the right way of doing it. You have an independent body that decides how much politicians are paid. It shouldn't be for politicians to opine on how much they themselves pay. Surely you agree with that?
Well, what I'm asking you, as our Shadow Secretary of State, I nearly promoted you there, as our Shadow Secretary of State, this is an absolute fair question. Do you believe that the DP's Trevor Clark is asking the question, why should it even be the case that our MLAs here should be paid the same as a member of the Scottish Parliament? Why would they be paid different?
I think that that's something that an independent body should consider. The independent body in Westminster looks at how politicians in similar jurisdictions are paid, similar levels of responsibility, similar levels of resourcing, and then it makes a decision, and that's what should happen in Northern Ireland.
Do you think the public are getting a fair deal from their politicians here in Northern Ireland in terms of delivery? When you look at the state of our roads, when you look at the health service, and so on.
I can absolutely understand when I talk to people in Northern Ireland, I can absolutely understand why they are impatient for improvement. Well, they want to see better roads, better public services, and so on. There are reasons. Yeah, there as I said at the top of our interview, there are reasons why things have gone unreformed for a period. We now have what we hope is stability. It is time for devolved institutions to deliver. And, you know, that is a case.
And
that
do you think it is delivering enough?
I think that someone's been back for a year. That's why it's right to have these conversations now. But that is exactly the sort of...
I'm having the conversation. I'm asking, do you think it's delivered
you're
enough?
You're looking backwards and I'm looking forwards, right? And what I am keen to see is that this is the moment where devolved power sharing is on a stable footing and we see the transformation that local people want.
Okay. We appreciate you coming on, Alex. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, Stephen. I appreciate it.
All the best. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. Thank you. Shadow Secretary of State, Alex Burkhardt, McFeely, Editor Slugger O'Toole, David Graham, former DUP Special Advisor. Morning, David. Morning, Mick.
Morning, Stephen. Morning, Mick.
What was interesting there, Mick, when we were talking at the outset, Alex was very much agreeing with Hilary Benn that it's time to get on with it.
No, and I think there has been a very useful reviling back to the bipartisan position that both Labour and Conservatives used to take on Northern Ireland issues. And it's important too that they don't stray into areas directly governed by the devolved institutions in Stormont. But I think what was refreshing in Hilary Benn's address was the bringing up of some of these data points, these quite shocking figures. You know, an eight-year waiting list, I think, is really beyond all things. But if I could push back slightly on behalf of the Stormont politicians, it's all very well to say, look, there are reasons why the reforms didn't happen, but they didn't happen. And they really, and it's not really to do with austerity, the more recent thing. It's to do with missing out when there was massive investment in the health service in England, Scotland and Wales in the early noughties when we went missing. I mean, one of the big controversies from that period is the PFI, the Private Finance Initiative, that we only have two hospitals that benefited from that, one in Omagh and one in Enniskillen. Because basically in 2002, everybody downed tools and we didn't have a health minister for the next 5 years. And by the time they come back in 2007, we're on the brink of the banking collapse. So we missed our opportunity for investment and capital investment. And the one thing you can say about the recent figures is 22.6 billion promised across the United Kingdom, but only 3.1 billion of that is set aside for the kind of capital investment that Belfast and Northern Ireland in particular needs to fulfil the Ben Gough recommendations.
It's not all about health, David Graham. But if we address what Hilary Benn did in that speech yesterday, was he was essentially having he was having a pop at the local politicians and saying to the local electorate, this is not acceptable that your standards here in Northern Ireland with regards to health are look how out of kilter they are with across the water. Now, different situation here, etc., etc. Was it fair for Hilary Benn to do that? And secondly, David, I remember, just as an anecdote, I remember the current chief medical officer. It was one of those big times in the Nolan show where Sir Michael McBride, he walked into this studio, he sat down, now we're going back over a decade now, and he sat down in this studio and he said, he warned of the consequences to the health service because of the lack of funding into it. Now, you're going back 10 years ago, David, Michael McBride nearly lost his job for coming in and publicly saying that. My goodness, look how right he was.
Oh yeah, look, Stephen, I think the point in Hilary Benn is quite clear. I think he's basically said, look, you can't have your cake and eat it. We campaigned very hard. I mean, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson grossly oversold a deal to restart Stormont. So the message from a unionist point of view was, look, having Stormont is better for unionism than not. And I think, to be fair, setting everything aside, I do empathise with that position, not entirely agree, but empathise with it. I think the issue that comes now is that we have had Stormont for a year. And really what Hilary Benn was saying is, listen, you've done really well. You've patted each other in the back. You know, you've all stood for photos. But actually what has been achieved, and I think that the difficulty for Hilary Benn, and I mean, I've said this publicly before, Stephen, the big problem for Stormont is that when we talk about reform, we seem to want to front load any reform with, by the way, Treasury, give us more money. Mm. And the difficulty is, when we look at health, as you asked me to address, Stephen, we have got too many trusts, we have got too many officials who are essentially clogging up a system which is stopping as much money going to the front line. And I think that the difficulty is Mike Nesbitt, as the current health minister, will never be given the political cover by the executive to make the necessary changes. And let's not forget, the current First Minister, when she was Health Minister, took on the Bangor report. And that lay in a cupboard. In fact, it's still probably lying on someone's desk, somewhere in the Department of Health. So we're 10 years down the line, Stephen. There's been no reform. So no matter how much money you get, it's never going to make the transformational changes that are required.
And Mick Fieldy, was Hilary Benn essentially saying yesterday there won't be any more money?
No, I don't think he was. And I think it's worth listening to something Alex Burkhardt just said there. There's no consensus, and it underlines something that David's just said. There's no consensus around what that reform looks like, because there's some difficult... I mean, Bengola laid it out in his report. There are difficult positions to be taken. If you're going to rationalise the hospital system, it means downgrading local hospitals and building up specialist units in places like Derry or Belfast. And that's deeply unpopular. We know this is deeply unpopular.
And I've been hearing that argument for, 10 years? So
exactly.
Have you.
But 15 here's the years? Thing. Here's the thing, Stephen. Right, if you count right back to 1997, we've had 11 and a half years of nobody doing any work in Stormont. And one of the reasons why I think it's better they're there than they're not is because you don't miss the funding rounds that were available in the early noughties to do exactly the kind of reforms that are now needed. Every time you take time off, you're losing opportunities. Now, one thing I would say is if you look at the Sláinte Care initiative in the Republic, that was developed in a parliamentary committee of all parties, huge consensus around it. Now, it's not going terribly smoothly, but there is an agreement and there's a consensus, and as David puts it, a political cover to get some of these difficult jobs done. There's no such thing in Stormont, and that's exactly what's needed.
Mick and David, thank you very much indeed. Some would argue that we only have enough money to stand still. I've heard that come from within political circles as well. Paul and Craigavon, I think we're back to MLA pay, Paul, are we?
We are indeed. Stephen, if you look at it, they're saying, this independent body, what criteria are they following? Are we going to follow a criteria that, because the ones in Scotland are getting this amount, we should get them?
Well, the Assembly Commission are saying in black and white it would be helpful for them to note, and they're also saying it's therefore highly likely that they'll get that MLAs will get a pay rise. So look at the steer the Assembly Commission's giving. And why is the Assembly Commission giving that steer rather than saying nothing? And letting review body.
How independent are they? But also look at it. On Butler this morning, you were saying some politicians aren't turning up for work. So should we not have an independent body?
That's what Robbie Butler said. We want to check that clip to see who he was talking about. He was talking about MPs.
If we set it up, Stephen, that this independent body goes like a school. They send inspectors into school, see if the schools are up to good quality for the teaching. So if we do the same with our MLAs and send in inspectors and auditors to check that these MLAs are turning up when they're supposed to be.
Robbie was talking about MPs, right? But it's interesting. How many times do MLAs turn up?
I've seen them around my estate lately there because elections are coming up, putting leaflets through my door. But you never see them any other time.
What do you think would be? They're currently on $52,000 a year, somewhere around that.
I think it should be performance-related pay because...
Do that, though? Who decides the performance?
Okay, this independent body will look at their targets for what needs done, i.e. the roads, education, the health service, what we need to get the health service numbers down. If you take that 19,000 multiplied by the 90 MLAs, that's 1.7 million. That could help the health service.
But they haven't had a pay rise since 2016.
Yeah, they were out for 3 years and still get paid. If you didn't turn up for work for 3 years, you wouldn't get paid, Stephen. They got money when they were out in strike, i.e. their strike. So are they getting value for money, the people?
But would you think it was fair today if you were working for the same amount of money today, 2025, as what you were getting in 2016? So that's the situation they're in.
Stephen, Northern Ireland is a PLC.
Look how much their bills have gone up over the last 9 years.
It's a private limited company, okay? If the politicians were in charge of this PLC and they weren't getting quality results from their employees, would they agree to give them a pay raise just because one's in the business across the water were getting it?
Paul, thank you. John and Dunamina, Good morning, Joe. I haven't spoken to you in a long time.
Well, it's not my fault, Stephen. It must be you.
How's sunny Dunamina?
Dunamina is basking in the glory of the sunshine of the Lord.
Is it?
Yes. Anyway, Hillary Benn, Secretary of State, yesterday made his speech.
Yes.
Now, that speech sets out basically that Stormont is a busted flush. It's not working. And it's not working.
He didn't say that.
Pardon?
He did not say that.
But if you take what his speech said, if he said that the waiting list was shocking, well, I can concur with him there. I'm waiting to have my left eye removed and a glass one put on because I've got glaucoma in my left eye, caused a lot of problems. And my waiting list is 2 years. Now, if you give me 2 wee minutes, I'll tell you a very, very quick story. I had a massive hernia. Now, when I say massive, that was massive. And I got to the point that I couldn't get out of bed. It was going to kill me. Do you know how I got the operation to get the hernia fixed? I got into Anthony Galvin Area Hospital, and I got admitted up onto the ward. And do you know how I got the operation, Stephen? I got the operation because I told them straight I wasn't getting out of the bed till they'd done the operation. And they had to bring the police and army to take me out of the bed. I got my operation. It saved my life because if I hadn't got that operation, that hernia, I was going to kill me.
Well, front page of the Irish News today, actually, it's a headline, Stampede for Private Healthcare. Alan Preston writing that there are record numbers of patients in Northern Ireland now opting for private healthcare as waiting
lists soar.
That
shouldn't be the case. At the end of the day, the Labour Party, 1948, 4th of July 1948, they brought out the National Health Service. And are they now going to sit now and dismantle it? I mean, the Tories started it off. Are the Labour Party, I mean, the party of the people? I mean, these are the party of the workers.
John, thank you. David, not along. Morning, David.
Hello. I was sitting listening to your MLAs talking about giving money away to charity, giving some of their...
Timothy Gaston. At least he came on. Where are all of the political parties when we're talking about their pay?
David, can I talk? I don't want him to give away his money, and I don't want him to give away his pay raise. We voted them in to do a job, to look at the problem and fix it. Please, just do your job. And as far as going to the Assembly, they need to have a roll book that you sign every day, and you must sign so many times a week to get your money, the same as...
Who do you think? Them.
Oh, yes, I do think. Because I watch the television, and there's some of them debates... There's not a sinner.
Do you remember there used to be a wee machine and you clocked in and clock out? Maybe we should have clocking in.
Yeah, we have that back because they're doing, you know, they're not doing the
job. David, thank you. Here comes the news. I see Kay Burley, Sky News, just releasing that Kay Burley has announced that she's retiring from Sky News after 36 years at Sky. It's all happened very quickly. Look at what Sky are saying. Closing her final show on the Sky News breakfast programme. Kay Burley said, so Kay going now after 36 years. She's been one of the, I think she's the longest serving at Sky. Really interesting, the whole change in the media market. Maybe my days are number two, who knows? But the whole change in the media landscape with these big, big broadcasters, Sky News fundamentally, changing its model. And you then see, if you think about it, traditional media really being challenged by streamers, traditional media being challenged by people sitting in tiny studios in their bedrooms or single presenters setting up their own networks. That's big news within the industry and for many, many people that have watched Sky News that Kay is going. Okay, look, 6 minutes past 10, 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning if you want to get in touch with us. A prominent Westminster committee will investigate the extent of surveillance of journalists, lawyers and human rights campaigners when it launches an inquiry into press freedom. The Northern Ireland Affairs Committee will hear evidence from journalists this morning including from the Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris. I've been speaking to her and began by asking her to remind me of some of the background.
The Northern Ireland Affairs Committee today are going to be looking at a story that I suppose has been in the headlines for quite some time now in relation to police surveillance on a number of journalists. There has already been an investigatory powers tribunal ruling in relation that they found that there was some surveillance and checking of some journalists' phones. That was in relation to a case by Barry McCaffrey and Trevor Burney, the documentary makers. But that was widened out to the PSNI have now ordered their own review. I think Angus McCullough is overseeing that. And the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee are looking at that and a number of other issues as well. So they also want to discuss threats to journalists, which is, I suppose, one of the reasons why I'm there as well. And then they're also looking at barriers to journalists, so such as, you know, fixatious litigation and other issues that we're experiencing that are a detriment to the press being able to operate freely.
And when you talk about that police review of surveillance, it would be the police involved in the surveillance, so are they reviewing themselves?
No, they have got a very senior barrister, Angus McCullough, who is operating independently, albeit he's been commissioned by the police, but he says that he is getting to look at the police records in relation to that. I also have submitted some notes to that review as well and would hope that they would look at what is the sort of concern that I have in relation to any surveillance on myself. The problem with the IPT, who looked at Trevor and Barry's cases, they can't give you a time limit as to how long that investigation might take. In their case, it took years. And so for the other journalists, solicitors and even some police civilian staff who have made those complaints recently, there is no idea when that might be completed, whereas the police review is something that we hope would be completed much sooner. And that's one of the things, I suppose, that I'd like to raise with the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee today, that they're, you know, that rather than go through all these reviews and investigations, that it would be much handier if the police would just hold their hands up and say, this is what happened then. We promise it's not going to happen now, but here's what happened in the past, and just be honest about that. And it would save us all a lot of time.
Do you think you were monitored illegally?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I think that there was, well, not just because there were things that happened on certain occasions that made me believe I was being monitored, but I've actually been told by sources and retired police officers that I was monitored and that there was intrusive surveillance on me at various times throughout my career in relation to some of the security work that I was doing. I also know, just through speaking to solicitors who would work in the sort of represent people in the same security field that maybe people I'd be speaking to, that on occasions those people's contact with me was brought up during police interviews. And that to me was really concerning, because in one case I understand as a security journalist I might get caught up on the surveillance surrounding some of the sources that I might speak to. But if then that's being raised about certain maybe conversations I might have had with these people, well then that I felt put my life at risk, because that could look as if I was passing that information on, and we know in Northern Ireland what the connotations of that are, and that could have been very dangerous for me and my family. So that's some of the things I want looked at as well. As well as that, you know, there are the MPs on the Select Committee are keen to listen to the threats that journalists work under in Northern Ireland, because that can be quite unique compared to anywhere else in the UK.
Yeah, tell me about it. It's for some journalists, Alison, you nearly get into the place where it comes with a job. And is that right?
Do you know, it really did. I had a conversation with one of my children yesterday, who are now all adults, and they said that they have a really strange relationship with fear, because I've always told them, no, don't worry, it's fine, don't worry, you know, don't pay any attention. You know, police would have called to the door, deliver threats, and I'm telling them not to worry about it, everything's grand. But yeah, probably last year, I would say, was the worst year in all my 20-odd years as a journalist in relation to threats being delivered to me by the police. You know, you get those TM1 forms. Yeah. To say you're under threat, and in the last 12 months, I think I've had about 8 of those.
I was, I think I'm revealing this for the first time. Actually, I was about to present a BBC television programme, and police came into the dressing room, and I thought, "What's going on here? What have I done?" And they were informing me that if I walked out into that studio, there was a credible threat against me and my family. And that was the level. They tried to take me out of doing a television show about 10 minutes before I walked into the studio. That's just a snapshot of what happens in this country. And I've never spoken about that before.
It is. I mean, and you obviously had, and I'm quite sure no one knew that you went out and did that television programme and didn't go home. Yes.
I did, because I needed to send a signal to these people. But it was terrifying.
Yeah, and I mean, in the last year, I suppose in the last 12 months, you know, I've had police at my door at 2:30 in the morning looking at my car for bombs. You know, I've had police come to the door and say, if you go to work today, there's that we have information that you're likely to be attacked on your way into the office. We have information that if you go and make contacts today, you're likely to be attacked, either shot. We have information that criminal gangs are targeting you, you know, and you get these regularly, and you have to then make a judgment call yourself as to what you're going to do or how you're going to adjust your behaviour in relation to it. I'm lucky I have very good employers who have done everything they can, I suppose, to put extra security and everything in place for me and allow me to work in sort of flexible ways. But at the same time, there's, you know, there's very few other journalists working in the UK doing what we do who would have to put up with that kind of nonsense or those kind of threats. You know, it's still remains a very dangerous place for people to work.
Okay, we'll be interested in watching your testimony today, Alison, and thanks for talking us through the story. Thanks very much indeed.
No problem.
Right, 0303 80 55 55 is our number. I hit my wee button there that cuts me off to you. Dare say some people would want that to be hit permanently. Yesterday, very serious story now, we spoke about the boxer John Cooney, who is in intensive care after a fight at the Ulster Hall on Saturday night. John collapsed following the fight. The contest was stopped by the referee in the 9th round. The former world champion Carl Frampton was on Nolan yesterday, and he told this programme of the fact that, look, he expects to have dementia later in life due to his long boxing career.
To be honest, I'm probably expecting, you know, the longevity in of my career and how long I was in boxing. I'm expecting at some point that I will have dementia or some sort of brain injury. But I'm just hoping it's when I'm, you know, 75 years old and not 50.
My goodness. So you're expecting dementia because of boxing?
Probably. If you look at what's going on in the sport and the amount of former fighters that this happens to.
The sporting journalist and boxing fan Jim Gracie with me this morning. Morning to you, Jim.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the neuroscientist Dr. Michael Gray from Loughborough University specialises in sports-related injuries. Good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. Jim, Carl was being very, very open. It was nevertheless certainly shocking for me to hear him be so open about the consequences of the job that he did so well.
Yeah, well, firstly, could I say I really, really hope and pray that John Cooney makes a full and complete recovery from his injury. But yes, Carl, searingly honest as ever. And, you know, the problem with this is, Stephen, it's a time bomb. It's a time bomb, not just in sport and society, but we just don't know what's going to happen. And I speak from personal experience here because I lost my own mother to dementia 2 years ago. So, I mean, I knew nothing about dementia 5 years ago, and now I know more about it than I ever wanted to know. So it really is a time bomb. The big problem with it is, Stephen, and it's a fact, you know, that people are living longer, whereas, you know, people used to die with it. Now they're dying from it. And it's not just confined to sport, and it's not just confined to boxing. But yes, boxing would be one of the big problems. And also, we're finding it now in football. I mean, I know, and I won't name anybody for their privacy, but I know of four or five footballers, Irish League footballers, who would have been household names in the 70s, now all suffering from dementia and living in care homes. I don't know what the answer is other than to try and make the sports a wee bit safer. Maybe our other commentator coming on here will be able to talk to us about that.
So you're saying you know of four or five former prominent Irish League footballers. Who are now in care homes with dementia because of...
Well, they put it down, their families would put it down to heading that big, heavy, sort of water-laden football that they played with in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we've had documented cases. I mean, and like one of the biggest, two of the biggest, Nobby Stiles, Gordon McQueen of Manchester United, Jeff Astle, West Bromwich Albion, and it's just the same here. The families here will put it down to head in the ball. But this is the time bomb, Stephen. You just don't know.
Which is essentially what Carl Frampton was saying yesterday, that, you know, time, as time ticks on, he expects, he just hopes it's away in later life, that he expects it to happen. And I guess, if you want to hear that Carl Frampton interview, by the way, it's on BBC Sounds. Search for yesterday's Nolan Show, and the Frampton interview is there in full. Dr. Michael Gray is a neuroscientist. I guess, is it really a surprise that if your job, if your daily living, if we look at boxing, is getting beat around the head, that you may suffer in the future as you get older?
Well, no, it's not. And we've known this for a long, very, very long time. I mean, it's only really in the public consciousness here in the last 20 years or so. And that's largely because of the lawsuit we all heard about with American football. In 1928, that's when the first study was published by a fellow called Martland, who showed that 17% of the people he was treating who were boxers showed, he called it then punch drunk syndrome, or then it was later called dementia pugilistica. That's far more than the average population. Later, I mean, as long ago as 1973, there were studies that were showing that people who box for 20 years or more, 80% of those boxers are going to experience dementia. So there's a pretty clear link.
Wow. So that's why Frampton was saying what he was saying, 80%?
For boxers who have been in the sport for more than 20 years, yes.
I'm astonished by that, but why should it be? It's maybe just my stupidity. And that was back in 73. What's the most recent research showing, Michael?
Well, it's similar. The issues now are really these we call them subclinical insults. For the longest time, we were thinking that, well, this is because people are getting knocked out. Then we were thinking it's because of concussions. People were equating being knocked out to having a concussion, when in fact only 10% of the concussions are actually resulting in loss of consciousness. We're talking about a sport here where the intention is to create a brain injury in the opponent. By definition,
well, it's not, is it?
So if you knock someone out, you are creating a brain injury in your opponent.
Well, are the majority of those, as you're describing them, brain injuries, not temporary, that the boxer's knocked out and, you know, seconds later they're conscious again, there's medical treatment around them and they're okay that week? Is that not the vast majority of cases?
That's not correct at all, no. The issue is more of the subconcussive insults, the ones where we're actually, you know, we don't experience a symptom. What we know now, it ties into the heading of the balls in association football. What we know now is that each and every time you do that, there's a little bit of damage. And the challenge we have is it's that repetitive insult of these low-level damages to the brain that accumulate over years. And that's what leads to the neurodegeneration. That's why we see in professional association football, we see somewhere between 2 and 9 times the incidence rate of a dementia compared with the
average. And what is it
actually
doing to the brain when you get repetitive blows, not enough to knock someone out, but it's just part of your sport? What's it doing to the brain?
Yeah, essentially, it affects the neurons in the brain. So the neurons are the bits of the cells in the brain that allow it to communicate with other areas of the brain, with organs in the body, with muscles in the body. So it's those communication bits, and there's these long pathways. You frequently hear something called white matter. So these axons, they're the things that get damaged. And so when we get these insults, we get these rapid accelerations and decelerations. Sometimes those nerves are damaged. Now, the challenge with neurodegeneration, including dementia, is that when these nerves break down, when they die, most of its components are soluble in the bloodstream, so they get excreted through the urine. But some of them, these tau proteins that we hear about, or the amyloid beta proteins that we hear about, they are not soluble. So they stick around in the brain, and they tend to clump together. They attach themselves effectively to specific areas in the brain but around blood vessels and other nerves, which causes decreased blood flow to those nerves and then even further dysfunction.
So if we take boxing, and then I want to talk about other sports. If we take boxing, which is a very, obviously, there's a lot goes with boxing. It's too simplistic just to knock it in terms of its health risks, because sense of community, people being fit and healthy and training for it, the discipline associated with it, and that amazing feeling that sportsmen get when they train, they work their lifetime, and people like Carl Frampton reach the heights that he did. Would you let your child box?
No. Yeah, quite simply, no. Especially in children, because children are more at risk. I'm not one of the people that are anti-boxing at all. It's not at all. If two people want to get in a ring and you know, go for it. As adults, knowing the risks, no problem. Children, completely different story. They're not consenting to this. They're not at the age of consent, are they? And from a neurology point of view, from a physiology point of view, they are more at risk of damage to the brain than as an adult.
Equally then, Michael, and Jim, we'll come back to you in a moment. I hope you're finding this as interesting as I am.
Certainly am.
Dr. Gray, equally, if you look at other contact sports, for example, rugby, what are the risks and do the benefits outweigh the risks in your view of children playing rugby at school? And I'm talking about force rugby, sixth year, 17-year-olds are powerful people.
That is a really good question. And it's actually the point of a research study that I'm conducting right now called the SCORES Project. So you were right a few moments ago when you said that sport is really good for the brain, and that's absolutely correct. The challenge that the benefits are that the physical activity, that aerobic activity, is not only good for the body, it's good for the brain. Preliminary results from my study, where we're looking at brain health in former sports people over the age of 40, show definitively that people under the age of 50, whether they're playing contact sport or not, have better brain health than the average population who do not play, who don't play sport. So, I mean, and that's really important. I really want to emphasize sport is good for the brain. However, with what we're finding with contact sport is over the age of 65, certainly for the professional level and to some extent for the amateur level, we are seeing much worse brain health compared with the average population.
When you say much worse, what do you mean?
Like significant differences between cognitive assessments in people over 65 who have played contact sport compared with those who
haven't. And more vulnerability to disease like dementia?
Yes.
Significantly more?
I don't have the data to say to extend it that far. We are looking at people with what we call mild cognitive impairments. So, I mean, the idea of this study is to track health over time. It's the only study in the UK that's actually doing this. And this is it's important. It's important for two reasons. One is that we need to understand the rate of decline compared with other people, because we all decline. It's just a fact that over the age of 40, all of our brains decline, whether we've played sport or not. We're questioning, does the rate increase or stay the same? Now, just one last point, because it's really, really important. I've been talking about high-level sport. We don't know what is the case for recreational sport, and that's the other thing that we're trying to investigate.
So, obviously, Carl Frampton has prompted us as a program, Jim Gracie, thinking about this. But it does lend itself to the dangers associated with high contact sports and choosing to do that for entertainment, in other words, boxing. Michael's explaining to us this morning that you benefit from it up to about 50, but you get over 65, you'll start paying the price, is essentially what he's saying. And so is it worth it? Jim?
Well, you see, you've struck a chord there, Stephen, because, you know, you talked earlier, too, about the highs that sports people experience, in, you know, in their particular sports. And in particular, you know, risk-driven sports, I mean, in a different way, motorcycle racing, you know, you talk about it quite a lot on your programme, the risks involved there. But with the likes of, you know, Carl and the boxers, you know, they're making informed choices. They know the risks about stepping into the ring, and they're making informed choices. Nobody pulls on a pair of football boots or rugby boots expecting to get dementia, and the other commentator there made a good point as well. You know, we all know about at the high level, we know the famous sportsmen and the guys at the top. We don't know what's happening at lower levels,
which is extraordinary. We need to know, don't we? We need to know on behalf of children, on behalf of that parent decision. Do they let their child go into, because they're the guardians at that stage, these high contact sports? And just to be fair to the boxing fraternity, by the way, you look at the likes of, I fly to America sometimes to watch the UFC, MMA, where people are getting battered, blood splattered all over the octagon. And it is, Michael Gray, and a growing sport, and it's athletes at the very top of their game.
Oh, it is, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of the biggest sporting entertainment businesses around now.
So what is the upsum of this? We can expect if we the figure is 80% of boxers who fight than 20 years are likely to have dementia when they get older. Is that it?
That's correct from this study in 1973. I don't think much has changed there. So I think the issue is knowing the risks. As I said before, I'm not against adults boxing, as long as they really do know the risk. And in some cases, maybe that sport outweighs the benefit outweighs the risk, you know, okay, for those that are going to do really well. The ones that I worry about are the sparring partners, you know, the ones that aren't going to be making a lot of money and do this job of being beaten up by their better opponent. They're the ones that I worry about the most, because they're the ones that are really suffering.
It's really interesting. Dr. Michael Gray, thank you. Jim Grissey, thanks as always. A lot to think about. Around that. And as Jim was saying this morning, our thoughts are with John Cooney, who is in intensive care fighting for his life. Thank you for listening today. We'll see you tomorrow for more Nolan at 9. Have a good day, everyone. Thanks again.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that
whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.